From the Ryerson Review of Journalism, this is Pull Quotes. I'm Jacob McNair.
And I'm Laura Howells. This week on the show, news continues to emerge about the alleged serial killer who preyed on Toronto's gay village. We'll talk about the media coverage around this story, but we'll also talk to activist and writer Tim McCaskill about coverage of Toronto's queer community in the decades since the Bathhouse raids, which just had their 36th anniversary.
But first, from Patrick Brown to Kent Hare, allegations of sexual misconduct have racked Canadian politics in the past few weeks, thanks in part to some excellent reporting from Canadian journalists. But reporters can also experience that harassment themselves.
Marie Danielle Smith is a politics reporter with the National Post. She recently wrote a candid piece about what it's like to be a female journalist on Parliament Hill. She talked about the time a senator asked her to sit next to him on the couch during an interview, or when an MP came up behind her, putting his hands on her waist on the dance floor at the press gallery dinner.
We really wanted to talk to Marie Danielle about the piece, so we called her at her office in Ottawa.
Marie Danielle, what has been going through your mind as these allegations have emerged over the last few weeks about sexual misconduct in Canadian politics?
It certainly makes you think about your own experiences, and you start to have conversations with your friends about, you know, whether we've heard of any allegations before regarding the people who are being named, other milder experiences that we may have had, these little moments that some people might label harassment, others might just kind of brush off in the moment, but you kind of recall any and all discomforts that you've had working around politics.
You wrote about these discomforts in your piece in the National Post, and I mean, you started off that piece talking about your mother, who worked as a staffer on Parliament Hill in the 80s and 90s. What did she tell you about her experience as a woman in politics during that time?
Yeah, it's been interesting. And this actually goes back to the fall, you know, when we started hearing publicly a lot more coming out with the Me Too movement and Harvey Weinstein and all these different names that started popping up. I remember going to my parents' house, and we were eating dinner, and my mother started out of nowhere kind of reminiscing about what it was like back in the day. And she told a few stories where, you know, she felt a bit uncomfortable at the time, but laughed it off. And it's funny because, you know, it wasn't really easy for her to brush off because, you know, it's been decades and she still remembers. So there are a couple examples that she gave me. One of them is she was working in a senator's office, and the senator who she was with, they were alone, sort of indicated that she should sit on his lap. He sort of gave a little pat on his lap, and it was really strange. And she kind of emphasized that none of her bosses ever did anything like that, and that the work environment was respectful for the most part. But even something like that was just kind of something that you had to brush off, and you didn't really mention to other people. And she had heard from some of her female friends working in and around the Senate and the House of Commons that they might have experienced similar things or worse as well.
So that was the 80s and 90s, and now a few decades later, you're working in that same environment, but I mean, as a journalist, not a staffer. What have you experienced as a female reporter working on Parliament Hill?
Yeah, so some of the things, you know, I have to say, they feel kind of minor, and it's an interesting moment that we're having now where I think it's important that we speak publicly about some of these little things as well as more serious issues of harassment. But things that I can certainly point to are little comments here and there or little looks here and there, you know, people sort of overtly checking you out, or like I've had friends tell me that they've caught MPs like staring at their breasts at a party kind of thing. Just kind of these little interactions where someone in a position of power and who you're supposed to cover is objectifying you or causing you some discomfort. So one example that I can give is from a political convention that I attended. There was a former MP who was there. He was quite a bit older. He was about, I'd say he was a solid 40 years older than me. And a couple interactions with him over the course of 24 hours really stuck with me. He he decided at a hospitality suite, which is like these little parties that they set up during the evenings at a convention in hotel rooms. He decided to, I wouldn't say he cornered me because I just kind of found myself next to him, but we were sort of standing alone in between crowds of people. And he decided to start telling me about being in a hot tub with naked ladies one time. It was really strange and weird. And I thought, man, this is like, I need to get out of here. This is so random because we had just met. And the next day he made a comment about my appearance in front of a male colleague who was also there. So just these little things, you know, you sort of, at the time, you sort of laugh it off and you think, well, this doesn't, it's not a big deal. This hasn't affected me or my job. Like I can keep going. I'm not traumatized. But these are the little things that happen all the time for young women who work on the Hill. And again, it's not every MP who's an offender, you know, not everybody behaves that way. But there certainly are some. And those who, I think, perpetrate those kinds of little comments and these little power struggles that happen, they do so with impunity because no one ever says anything.
Yeah, your piece was really interesting because I haven't seen a lot of writing from female journalists in particular talking openly about their own experiences of these kind of encounters on the Hill. Why don't you think we see more women in political journalism talk about this kind of culture?
Yeah, that's a good question. I felt a little bit like I was filling a void there. I think a big part of it is that, you know, we're trying not to be part of the story. I think I called it in my piece one of those cardinal sins, you know, you don't want to put yourself in the middle of the action when it's your job to tell other people's stories. And we have seen a lot of journalists, female journalists on the Hill, speak with staffers and other women and tell their stories of harassment. But it's true that I don't think it matters what job you have. If you're a young woman on the Hill, older women as well, and also some young men as well, these things happen. So I thought it was important to talk about. But yeah, I think it has to do with not putting yourself in the story. And also you sort of risk, it's a risk, right? You put yourself out there. You don't want to start rumors about yourself or have people look at you any differently when they approach you about a story or when you go to them for comment. So I think it's a bit risky, and, you know, that doesn't mean that nothing is happening.
I mean, you talk about the Hill being such a small place. There's also the concern maybe of, you know, burning a source or losing out on potential scoops.
Yeah, and I mean, you'll notice that I didn't name anyone in the piece, so there's still concerns around that, you know, for sure.
You talk about not wanting to start rumors, but, you know, the Hill being a kind of rumor mill. I mean, how big of a role do rumors and whispers play in that environment?
Oh, a pretty big role. And, you know, people who are involved with politics and political journalism, too, tend to love gossiping. You know, it's fun. And the thing is, sometimes we fail to consider the implications of gossip when it's of a sexual nature, for example. The implications on people's reputations. I think that when we hunt for stories in politics, you know, a lot of stories start out as a rumor or a lead that we got just from a conversation, you know, at the bar at a reception. So it's certainly part of the lifestyle and the way that we try to gather news here. It's that social culture where you're dealing in off the record situations much more often than I think journalists in other fora. And a lot of those sort of off-the-cuff socializing with politicians and with other journalists is how we develop sources and find ideas for stories. And that whisper network and rumor mill is part of it. We, I think, warn each other when we've encountered someone who's a bit creepy. You know, we'll tell our friends or other female journalists. So I'll mention when something weird happened with someone. And I think the same happens with staffers and MPs, for example. But yeah, like one thing I'll mention too is that you really try to be careful with the fact that so much consensual sex happens. It's just part of the culture. And you worry about things like, okay, like a staffer told me, I'd better not go out for drinks with this one person after a certain hour, or I'd better not join this person in their office for a private meeting after a reception, because people are going to start whispering, even if nothing happens. People are going to start starting rumors, and I've heard people talk about female journalists that way too, where they're like, well, she wrote a pretty nice story about this one politician. I wonder if they're sleeping together. And people just kind of throw it right out there without thinking, and that's how it all starts.
Yeah, you talk about how kind of frequent consensual sexual relationships are on the Hill. I mean, and the extent to which that complicates the whole Me Too discussion when it comes to politics and sort of muddies the waters there.
I think it does, and I think it's sometimes missing from the conversations that we have. You know, the fact that consensual relationships are there means that, you know, they have to start somehow. And it adds a sort of a different dimension to how we think about harassment and whether, you know, certain people who are perpetrating what we think is harassment may not see it that way themselves, because maybe they've had some consensual experiences that began in much the same way. And I think that's part of the discussion and the nuance of all of this that we lose sometimes, especially when we're debating it on social media, in places where we get this kind of echo chamber where everybody seems to fall on one side or the other, as we're seeing now, for example, with the allegations against Patrick Brown. There seem to be two camps and little room for discussion in between.
That's interesting, especially, I mean, on the other side of things, you're talking about a lot of the harassment and uncomfortable moments you experience as being kind of hard to put your finger on, or maybe just weird moments that you might shrug off too, that aren't sort of clear things you can point to or to as reportable offenses.
Yeah, exactly. And then sometimes you think, well, should I report it because it's not that serious, quote unquote. And you sort of go back and forth in your head, and everyone will draw the line at a different spot. So it's tough. And you know, even when it comes to the consensual relationships that go on, not everybody has the same opinion of what's inappropriate. For example, some people, and I'll use examples again from my mother, in the 80s and 90s, she remembers parliamentarians having affairs with their staff, and this not being particularly uncommon and not necessarily looked down upon either. She remembers one relationship actually resulted in a marriage. So, you know, it's people draw different lines. And I think today you would certainly have some people arguing that any relationship at all between people at different levels of power is inappropriate. And you'd have others saying something quite different. So there's no consensus. And that makes it really difficult to figure out, you know, what's relevant to report and you know, what should just get left alone.
CBC host Carol Off recently published a piece in The Globe where she talked about having, you know, similar experiences as a political reporter in the 80s. And she talked about how when journalists at the time spoke out, they were ostracized and made a laughingstock of in Parliament, but also in the press gallery. And that reporters at the time were kind of complicit in this sort of toxic political culture. How much support do you feel like reporters and people in political journalism lend each other now?
Yeah, I think this old boys club mentality is on its way out. What Carol described, I think there's still a little bit of that, and you know, and there's pockets of that will continue to exist probably, but I'm in a generation of younger journalists on the Hill, my peers, mostly in their 20s and 30s, who are a very supportive bunch. And I think, you know, it may not be the best example, but even if I just think about the response that I received after writing my piece, uniformly positive across the board from colleagues in journalism. And I think that's kind of a sign that, you know, and I'm detailing stuff in there that you know, would have been absolutely laughed off in the 80s and probably wouldn't have gotten written about. I think it just shows that the culture is shifting ever so slightly and slowly. And that I think if a colleague of mine in the press gallery described an unfortunate incident with a politician, I'm sure that person would be surrounded with support. And I think, you know, we're starting to feel safer about bringing up all kinds of incidents, whether they're serious or not so serious.
Well, the government now is debating this legislation that would strengthen harassment regulations on Parliament Hill. But, I mean, as we were talking about, so much of this toxic culture is in these little weird moments, and there's all these other complicating factors. I mean, what do you think actually needs to change in order to create a better culture for women on the Hill?
I think more women on the Hill would probably go a long way. More women in positions of power, and that's changing. And I don't mean to say that in an activist way, but I think it's been proven that if the ratio of women to men in a workplace is more even, these types of behaviors are more difficult to perpetrate, and people kind of have each other's back. Women have each other's backs. So I think, if we have more women involved in politics, and much of the press gallery is female. We were pretty good for the gender ratio in the press gallery, but more female politicians would certainly, I think, change the political culture, and as well, just feeling free to talk about these incidents without shame and without fear of repercussion. I think the idea that we are coming to a point where there's no shame in mentioning something weird happened with someone, no shame in sometimes naming the perpetrators of more serious offenses, I think that goes a long way, and we'll continue to probably see more stories emerge in the next weeks and months about people who are coming forward and trying to sort of eradicate the Hill in a way, or eradicate politics of the kind of old boys mentality that would allow some of these things to take place unmitigated.
That was National Post reporter Marie Danielle Smith.
Last month, police arrested Bruce MacArthur and charged him with the death of five men with ties to Toronto's gay village. And there may be more victims.
But as recently as December, police were saying there was no evidence that a serial killer was connected to the disappearances and deaths. Even though members of Toronto's LGBTQ community have been concerned for years about the wave of men who've gone missing from the village.
Anthony Oliveira recently wrote an essay in Hazlitt called Death in the Village. It's a really beautiful and heart-wrenching piece, and it's also scattered with critiques of media coverage. So we called up Anthony, and we asked him what he thought of the media's response to this news.
I think the media response to not just the serial killings that have been going on in the village, but a lot of the adjacent, and I think analogous, and systemic problems, the murder of Tess Ritchie, the death of Allura Wells, are of a piece with what I think is the general public's response to the village and also the police response to the village, which has been largely incoherence and inadequacy. I think that the media are frequently well-intentioned in their approach to queer issues, but I think some of their worst habits tend to do damage to the quality of their reporting. The over-reliance on police report, the over-reliance on statements issued from above rather than any kind of on-the-ground journalism. I think that the response to the Bruce MacArthur arrest has been extremely indicative of newsrooms that don't have queer people on staff. Watching them struggle to sort of even just characterize what MacArthur's relationship to these men was has been unfortunately enlightening, I think.
What do you mean by that?
I spoke to quite a few people who, for example, were friends with some of the men who were slain. They may have slept with them a few times, and the media doesn't seem to understand that that's actually quite a normal kind of relationship. A lot of gay men have that sort of relationship with their friends. They instead, during the press conferences, were sort of trying to figure out, well, what to call these men. Are they partners? Watching the kinsmen sisters being asked questions about their brother's relationship with the killer, which they were not equipped to answer. I think that that's just one symptom of the general problem. I think the media does its best, but I do wish it hadn't taken the police at their word quite so much throughout this investigation. For at least a decade now, the Church in Wellesley community has been saying that there's been these killings are connected. There is a serial killer operating in the village. And no one in the media really took them seriously because the police didn't take them seriously.
You talked about in your piece this kind of fixation on Bruce MacArthur and the fact that he was a mall Santa. What do you make of that?
I did, yes. I think that I understand the impulse to reach. One of the things the police did in letting this story be reported is they left MacArthur's Facebook page up for a few days, which they seem to have learned from in the aftermath, because when Tess Ritchie's killer the arrest was made, Kaylin Schlatter, his entire online presence seems to have been scrubbed. Because they didn't do that for MacArthur, basically his life became sort of this mine for as much sensationalist material as was possible, including this Mall Santa stuff. I find the Mall Santa thing very frustrating, and I think a lot of gay men find it frustrating, because I think the reason the Mall Santa thing became the fixation was it became a peg where people could say, oh, what if my kid had been in his lap? What if we went to the mall and a serial killer had dandled my son or daughter on their knee? And I think that was a way, that is a way to see yourself as a victim of this killer, but it is a way to marginalize the actual people that he preyed on. There's no way the mall could have known that the man they were hiring was a serial killer, and it's not really a germane detail in this story. He wasn't targeting children. He wasn't targeting straight families. He was targeting gay men, and making this about making him into the Mall Santa killer is ghoulish in one direction, but is also incredibly marginalizing in another.
That was Anthony Oliveira, a writer and academic in Toronto. Obviously, this has been a huge story since MacArthur was arrested, and we wanted to talk about the media coverage on the show. But when we were working on the episode, we also realized that this week marked the anniversary of another dark moment for Toronto's gay village, the bathhouse raids. On February 5th, 1981, police stormed four bathhouses in the village. Armed with crowbars and sledgehammers, they arrested hundreds of men and caused substantial property damage.
The raids gave rise to huge resistance and galvanized the gay liberation movement. Tim McCaskill is an author and activist, and he was part of The Body Politic, a monthly queer magazine that was hugely influential in that movement.
Thank you so much for talking to us today, Tim.
Pleasure.
The knowledge that a serial killer has been targeting Toronto's gay village is huge and horrible news, especially for the LGBTQ community, and it's attracted a lot of intense media focus. And we wanted to talk about the media coverage, but as I was doing research on Monday, I also realized that this week marked the 36th anniversary of the Toronto bathhouse raids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe I wasn't looking in the right places, but it felt like there wasn't a whole lot of acknowledgement of that anniversary in the mainstream media.
I don't recall there being anything about the anniversary. It seems that the event has receded so far into the past now that people tend to celebrate it or talk about it on every 5 years or every 5 years or so becomes a significant date. But no, there hasn't been anything this year. And then, of course, the gay news quota, I think, has been completely filled by the serial killer story at this point.
You were involved with the Body Politic
right.
at the time. Can you just briefly explain what that was?
The Body Politic was called itself a magazine for gay liberation. It had its first issue, I think, in 1971. And continued until the mid-80s, 87. And for that period, it was one of the world's most respected and best distributed lesbian and gay newspapers. We had about a third of our issues in Toronto, a third in the rest of Canada, and a third internationally. It was really Canada's voice of gay liberation in those early years of the struggle.
Mm. And it played a real key role in the resistance after the raids, too, right?
That's right. I mean, the the body politic, I mean, the story of that night, I got a call. I was just falling to sleep from somebody, from Gerald Hannon, the body politic, who said, they're raiding the baths, you need to get down to the club baths right away. And so I grumblingly went out into a cold February night to find the police there carting people away and releasing some people. And so I think the body politic played a major role in terms of the response. The meeting that happened the next day happened to the body politic offices, and that was probably because it was one of the few lesbian and gay organizations in the city that actually had offices. So it was a place that people could actually meet.
How do you remember the mainstream media's response to that riot and to the raids?
Well, it was front page news in The Star, and I suppose The Sun. So nobody read The Sun because it was so homophobic in those days, and I think still is generally. And so, you know, it was big news. A riot in Toronto doesn't happen every night, right? So I think there was also a certain amount of sympathy for the first time for a community, because the police tactics had been so extraordinarily heavy-handed. You know, they'd marched in, they'd kicked down doors instead of simply opening them. They ripped lockers off the walls with crowbars instead of asking people for the combinations. One bath, there was so much damage that it basically had to close because the cost of renovating it afterwards was going to be so expensive, and no bank would lend them any money because this was a place that was under charges. So they simply closed right away. The other baths managed to repair themselves and stayed open. So I think among the good citizens of Toronto who expect the police to be, you know, officer friendly, to see this kind of violence let loose against a particular community who, as people said, were doing, you know, in their own spaces, not bothering anybody else, was a bit of a shock. And I think much of the mainstream media sympathized with the community's reaction, and also was surprised by the amount of militancy that that reaction engendered.
Do you think it marked a kind of turning point in how the queer community was covered?
Oh, definitely. I definitely think all of a sudden, I mean, the only way that a gay story was covered was when there was like a sex arrest or a murder or something, right? I mean, the gay community was indelibly written into people's minds as associated with sex and violence and sleaze. And so for the first time, we were seen as, I suppose, victims of police brutality, but also a community that was willing to come out and be militant and demand its rights and demand the end of that kind of behavior. And a community that, at that point, developed alliances with black communities and South Asian communities who were also facing a lot of police racism and violence in those days. And so I think the media began to realize that Toronto had a serious problem with the way policing was done, and all minorities were being caught up in this.
So after that, how do you remember media coverage changing in the subsequent years and decades?
Well, the big fight right after the bath raids was there was a report, finally. A report was done for City Hall called the Bruner Report, and they called for many recommendations, but one of the recommendations was that the police recognize the lesbian and gay community as a legitimate community in Toronto, and the police absolutely refused to do that. And so the police intransigence, they dug themselves deeper and deeper and deeper, and so the media, I think, became more and more sympathetic. And remember, this is 81. 81 is also the year that AIDS starts to happen in the States. It doesn't really begin to have a kind of a conscious impact on the public until probably 83 or 84 in Canada. So the bath raids produced a kind of a sympathetic stance to the community by much mainstream media, and then this notion of an epidemic, which was two-sided. On the one hand, gay men were seen once again as victims of this terrible disease. On the other hand, there was a relinking of homosexuality with disease and death and illness. And so the media struggled with those two tropes for many years, by the end of the 80s, kind of celebrity culture, the Elizabeth Taylors and the Hollywood stars, had begun to come out, develop the red ribbon, the notion of the red ribbon, and so there was this recognition that this was a beleaguered community that needed to be supported, and that a community that in fact was struggling to take care of its own members who were ill and dying. And then AIDS activism burst onto the scene as well. And so once again, you had this kind of people being militant and out and in your face and demanding our rights as human beings. And I think that as well began to carry the media story and changed media's understanding of the community in relatively profound ways. And by the time we're into the mid-90s, then the struggle is around spousal benefits and gay people not as some sort of strange other monster, but people just like you or like everybody else who just want to get married and settle down, right? And so there's a kind of homonormative trope in the media that began to see gay people not as something to be feared, but something really ordinary and citizens like everyone else. And when bad things happened to those citizens, then the community, like the broader community, needed to rally around.
Now, of course, you know, in the last few weeks, there's again been intense media coverage around the gay community with the news of the serial killer targeting the community. And then, and I mean, there's similarly been criticism around how police have responded to the missing men and to the murders and whether or not they took some of these disappearances seriously enough.
Yeah.
What do you make of the media coverage you're seeing now and what it says about the media's relationship with this community?
I mean, it's certainly a real change from the 80s. One of my criticisms of the media coverage is that they haven't had much to say for a long time, and so they keep repeating the same story over and over and over again because they want to keep it in the news because it's a big story. But on the other hand, actual details are leaking out very, very slowly. And so, you know, you read the morning paper, and it's like, I read that yesterday. On the other hand, the media has certainly covered events like the Metropolitan Community Church's candlelight vigil the other night, and that included talk of the way that police racism and homophobia have probably affected this investigation. I mean, the first men, most of them South Asian men or Middle Eastern men, disappeared, I think, 2010. Like that's 8 years ago now, and it wasn't until the more recent murder that police began to take this more seriously. People in the community have been saying, yeah, there's something strange going on here, like where there's all these disappearances, and the police kept saying, oh, there's no sign of a serial killer, there's no sign that these things may be connected. And then all of a sudden, bang, it was revealed that yes, they did seem to be connected, and it looks like the same person was responsible for all of them. So the media often simply follows the police's lead. You know, you write a media story based on the police report, and if the police says there's no serial killer here, then there's no story. And the fact that people in the community are saying there's something more serious going on here, well, that isn't authorized talk, and therefore it doesn't make its way into the story. There's no, you know, you've got no one to interview there that has authority to say those kinds of things.
I mean, you were talking earlier about an increasing kind of normalization of the LGBTQ community in the media throughout the 90s and the aughts. I mean, do you feel at all like this, I think what's the term you use, like homonormativity?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that gives a false impression of some of the real struggles or issues that are in the community, or maybe kind of erases or leads the media to, I don't like talking about the media as kind of a monolith, but leads us to kind of forget about sort of how recently things were so, so radically different?
Yeah, and it's not just that things are so radically different in the past, but for many people, things haven't changed very much, and that the couple on Modern Family, right, who adopt a child and, you know, white gay couple who play with the stereotypes but are accepted by their family, all of that kind of stuff. You know, that's not the life that many, many people still live. We're a society that's now much more disparate, with much more disparity than in the 70s or even in the 80s. People are really, really much poorer now. 50% of the people in Toronto are working in precarious jobs, according to reports. And 50% of the population as well, I think, is living in what's considered poor areas. And so the kinds of stresses that come from poverty and racism and, you know, being an immigrant in a often unwelcoming society and being queer on top of that mean that many people don't feel that their lives are normative, right? Because they're not quite white, they're not middle class, they don't have good jobs, right? They're struggling, and therefore their sexual orientation or gender identity is kind of part and parcel of the things that they struggle with every day, and so they don't feel that they're as accepted by society as the media would sometimes lead you to believe all gay people are.
That was writer and activist Tim McCaskill, who was part of the Body Politic during the 70s and 80s. That's it for Poll Quotes this week. Poll Quotes is a production of the Ryerson Review of Journalism. And you can find more stories about journalism and media at rrj.ca. Get in touch on Twitter at PullQuotesRRJ or email pullquotes@ryerson.ca.
This podcast is produced by Jacob McNair, Emily Pardo, and me, Laura Howells. Executive producers are Sonia Fatta and Stephen Trumper. Special thanks to Angela Glover for all her technical help.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.